places beloved of people who plan the newer government buildings. A number of bureaucratic hangers-on from Quantico had attached themselves to the project from above, so we had a good-sized crowd. But this was my baby, so I made the presentation. The others ate their lunches and didn't say much. I had a sandwich in front of me, but couldn't really eat it because I was very busy talking. Director Webster was a cool and collected man, skilled in not revealing his emotions, and during my pitch, I received no sign that he either liked or disliked the idea. He was so hard to read that I despaired of trying. At last, however, I made the point that this project had been previously rejected by the Radish, and that got his attention because Webster had been brought in to move the Bureau in new directions. Now the director went from passive to active and, in an action that was somewhat amazing in the light of usual bureaucratic procedure, we got a go-ahead at the same lunch meeting in which we presented. He endorsed the project, but only if it was done correctly. He didn't want it conducted on a haphazard basis. The phrase he used to deprecate the ordinary way of doing it was shoebox research. He insisted that we collaborate with first-class universities and hospitals, and was pleased that the major collaborators I had chosen came from Boston University and Boston City Hospital, and that others included in the project were among the country's recognized academic experts in psychiatry, psychology, and the study of criminal behavior. They were all people I had met at conferences and had been talking to for years. Shortly, the project was approved all up and down the hierarchical ladder of the FBI. Later, I was amused to learn that the session with Webster had truly been a working lunch, for I got a memo asking for $7 for the sandwich I had not eaten because I was too busy talking. But we had a go, and that was what was really important. In the ensuing months, too, we obtained funding for some of the research from the Department of Justice. Now we'd even be able to spend an entire week interviewing inmates and not have to piggyback that research onto a road school. Before the Criminal Personality Research Project was funded, but when I knew that approval and funding were solidly in the works, I decided to go and see William Herons, the killer in whom I had been so interested when I was 9 years old. An associate and I were, as usual, at a road school, this one in St. Louis, when we drove to a Southern Illinois correctional facility to see Herons. Herons had been in prison for more than 30 years and was now a man in his late 40s. I explained to him that I'd been intrigued by his crimes since childhood, and that, in a sense, we had grown up together in Chicago. He'd been 17 when I was 9, and now the age difference of 8 years seemed even less a barrier than it had been. In the interim between the 1940s and the 1970s, I'd learned a lot about Herons, about the sexual content of his murders, about the string of fetish burglaries that had preceded them, about the many unsolved attempted murders and slashings to which he had been tentatively connected, and about his ability to conceal his crimes from family and friends. His initial defense had been as extraordinary as his crimes. He claimed that the crimes had been done by another person, George Merman, who had lived with him. Herons had even taken investigators to the sites of the three murders and had been able to retrace his actions during those murders, which gave the lie to his pinning them on George Merman. Only under close questioning had he admitted that George Merman lived inside his head. Herons was not really a multiple personality, but his problems had begun and become evident when he was quite young. They blossomed to visible proportions as a teenager. He had sexual fantasies, and in the secrecy of his room pasted pictures of Nazi leaders into a scrapbook and stared at them while trying on women's undergarments. After he was discovered to have an arsenal of pistols and rifles in addition to the secret photos, and admitted to several burglaries and fire settings, he'd been sent to a Catholic boarding school as an alternative to incarceration. In a few years, he had completed his studies at the boarding school, and his behavior was deemed appropriate to re-entering society, especially since he had done so well academically that he was going to be allowed to skip most of his freshman year work at the University of Chicago and take some advanced studies. His murders began shortly after he was let out of the boarding school, and in retrospect could be seen as a continuation of the burglaries and other crimes he had committed earlier in his teenage years. In fact, in between the murders, Herons committed many more burglaries. Herons had never actually gone to trial. In pretrial work, psychiatrists had advised his counsel that although Herons might be able to claim that he was subject to becoming George Merman, murder man, and not really responsible for his actions at certain times, no jury would understand or believe that, and if tried, he would undoubtedly be given a death sentence. The evidence against him, consisting of fingerprints, handwriting, and his confession, was overwhelming. The alternative to a trial was to plead guilty, and for the psychiatrists to recommend a prison sentence and treatment. Herons took the bargain, pleaded guilty, and was sentenced to life. After his conviction, his parents divorced, changed their names, and started accusing each other of having been responsible for their son's crimes. As for Herons, since his conviction, he had been a model prisoner, the first prisoner in the state to complete his bachelor's degree while incarcerated, and had even gone on to postgraduate work. I was really primed for my interview with this man, whose life I had been following since childhood, but the interview didn't go as well as I'd hoped. He did respond to my knowing a lot about him, but he no longer wished to admit to the crimes to which he had once pleaded guilty. He had decided he'd been framed, and so would no longer acknowledge, as he had done in the 1940s after his arrest, that he had killed two adult women who surprised him while he was in their homes, or that he had strangled and dismembered a 6-year-old girl. I remembered particularly that he had overpowered Suzanne Degnan in her bed. Only after that did he kill the little girl, roll her in a blanket, take her to a basement for dismembering, and then coolly dispose of the body and return to his dormitory room. Here was a monster, now denying his culpability. Herons did acknowledge having had some sexual problems, and having committed the break-ins that he now deprecated as adolescent pranks. He said he'd never been a danger to society, and that his years as a model prisoner qualified him to spend the remainder of his life out of prison. A disappointment. The larger issue, however, the attempt to learn from carefully conducted interviews with convicted serial killers some information that would be helpful to law enforcement, was now on track, part of an established program within the Bureau and the Department of Justice. In time, I would personally interview more than 100 of the most dangerous violent criminals in the prisons of the United States, and train others to continue this task, and with the information so gained, add significantly to our understanding of many murderous patterns and how to apprehend the people in whose minds those patterns were born. In his youth, Bill Herons had written on a wall in lipstick, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." I would interview serial murderers in an attempt to learn how to do just that. 3. Interviews with murderers. I was nearing the end of my third interview with Edmund Kemper, an enormous man, 6 feet 9 inches in height and weighing nearly 300 pounds, a man of extremely high intelligence who, in his youth, had killed his grandparents, spent 4 years in youth facilities, then had emerged, only to kill 8 more people, including his mother. Kemper was serving 7 consecutive life terms. Twice before, I had ventured into the Vacaville prison in California to see and talk with him. The first time, accompanied by John Conway, the second time by Conway and by my Quantico associate John Douglas, whom I was breaking in. During those sessions, we had gone quite deeply into his past, his motivations for murder, and the fantasies that were intertwined with those crimes. This was a man of great intellectual complexity, whose murders had included the beheading and dismembering of his victims. No one had ever succeeded in talking to him in the ways and at the depths we had achieved. I was so pleased at the rapport I had reached with Kemper that I was emboldened to attempt a third session with him alone. It took place in a cell just off death row, the sort of place used for giving a last benediction to a man about to die in the gas chamber. Although Kemper was in the general population rather than isolated from it, this was the place that the prison authorities had chosen for our interview. After conversing with Kemper in this claustrophobic locked cell for 4 hours, dealing with matters that entail behavior at the extreme edge of depravity, I felt that we had reached the end of what there was to discuss, and I pushed the buzzer to summon the guard to come and let me out of the cell. No guard immediately appeared, so I continued on with the conversation. Most serial murderers are pretty much loners. Even so, they look forward to anything that eases the boredom of their confinement, and that includes visits such as mine. They have a lot on their minds, and properly approached, they are inclined to talk. Conversations with them are rather readily prolonged. Kemper and I had now talked ourselves out, though. After another few minutes had passed, I pressed the buzzer a second time, but still got no response. 15 minutes after my first call, I made a third buzz, yet no guard came. A look of apprehension must have come over my face despite my attempts to keep calm and cool, and Kemper, keenly sensitive to other people's psyches, as most killers are, picked up on this. "Relax. They're changing the shift, feeding the guys in the secure areas." He smiled and got up from his chair, making more apparent his huge size. "Might be 15-20 minutes before they come and get you," he said to me. Though I felt I was maintaining a cool and collected posture, I'm sure I reacted to this information with somewhat more overt indications of panic, and Kemper responded to these. "If I went apeshit in here, you'd be in a lot of trouble, wouldn't you? I could screw your head off and place it on the table to greet the guard." My mind raced. I envisioned him reaching for me with his large arms, pinning me to a wall in a stranglehold, and then jerking my head around until my neck was broken. It wouldn't take long, and the size difference between us would almost certainly ensure that I wouldn't be able to fight him off very long before succumbing. He was correct. He could kill me before I or anyone else could stop him. So I told Kemper that if he messed with me, he'd be in deep trouble himself. "What would they do? Cut off my TV privileges?" he scoffed. I retorted that he would certainly end up in the hole, solitary confinement, for an extremely long period of time. Both he and I knew that many inmates put in the hole are forced by such isolation into at least temporary insanity. Kemper shrugged this off by telling me that he was an old hand at being in prisons, that he could withstand the pain of solitary, and that it wouldn't last forever. Eventually, he would be returned to a more normal confinement status, and his trouble would pale before the prestige he would have gained among the prisoners by offing an FBI agent. My pulse did the 100-yard dash as I tried to think of something to say or do to prevent Kemper from killing me. I was fairly sure that he wouldn't do it, but I couldn't be completely certain, for this was an extremely violent and dangerous man with, as he implied, very little left to lose. How had I been dumb enough to come in here alone? Suddenly I knew how I had embroiled myself in such a situation. Of all people who should have known better, I had succumbed to what students of hostage-taking events know as Stockholm Syndrome. I had identified with my captor and transferred my trust to him. Although I had been the chief instructor in hostage negotiation techniques for the FBI, I had forgotten this essential fact. Next time, I wouldn't be so arrogant about the rapport I believed I had achieved with a murderer. Next time. "Ed," I said, "surely you don't think I'd come in here without some method of defending myself, do you?"
"Don't shit me, wrestler. They wouldn't let you up here with any weapons on you."
Kemper's observation, of course, was quite true, because inside a prison, visitors are not allowed to carry weapons, lest these be seized by inmates and used to threaten the guards or otherwise aid in escape. I nevertheless indicated that FBI agents were accorded special privileges that ordinary guards, police, or other people who entered a prison did not share.
What have you got, then?
I'm not going to give away what I might have or where I might have it on me.
Come on, come on. What is it? A poison pen?
Maybe. But those aren't the only weapons one could have.
Martial arts, then, Kemper mused.
Karate? Got your black belt?
Think you can take me?
With this, I felt that the tide had shifted a bit, if not turned. There was a hint of kidding in his voice, I hoped, but I wasn't sure, and he understood that I wasn't sure, and he decided he'd continue to try and rattle me. By this time, however, I had regained some composure and thought back to my hostage negotiation techniques, the most fundamental of which is to keep talking and talking and talking, because stalling always seems to defuse the situation. We discussed martial arts, which many inmates studied as a way to defend themselves in the very tough place that is prison, until at last a guard appeared and unlocked the cell door. The procedure is for the interviewer to remain in the room while the guard takes the inmate back to his own cell. As Kemper got ready to walk off down the hall with the guard, he put his hand on my shoulder.
You know I was just kidding, don't you?
Sure, I said, and let out a deep breath. I resolved never to put myself or any other FBI interviewer in a similar position again. From then on, it became our policy never to interview a convicted killer or rapist or child molester alone. We'd do that in pairs. The Criminal Personality Research Project was my baby, and as it got going in the late 1970s, I threw myself into it, taking opportunities when I was out of town at road schools to interview men and a few women in various prisons around the country. Before I stopped doing all the interviewing myself and turned the task over to associates, I had interviewed more than 100 convicted violent criminals, more than any other man alive. My efforts were eventually recognized within the FBI and by associated institutions when I twice won the Jefferson Award, announced annually by the University of Virginia, for which the FBI's Quantico campus functions as an extension school. The information collected from these interviews was systematized and analyzed for the CPRP, and eventually my research associates and I were able to discern and document certain patterns in the backgrounds and behaviors of these murderers. The patterns of their childhoods and adolescences, their pre-crime stresses, and the ways in which they acted during their crimes forms the basis of several later chapters in this book. Before going into those conclusions, however, I want to concentrate on the art of interviewing convicted murderers and on a few of the highlights of the time I spent in small rooms inside various prisons, speaking with these intense people who had committed the crime held by society to be the most serious of all offenses. Interviewing violent criminals is only valuable insofar as it can provide insight into their actions and personalities that can be of importance to law enforcement. To extract such information, the interviewer needs to be taken seriously by the inmate and to achieve a level of trust so that the inmate will talk freely. And to do that, you have to earn the inmate's respect. Establishing respect requires a good deal of masking your personal feelings about the heinous crimes these people have committed. If, while a murderer was describing the way he had mutilated a body, I had conveyed my disgust by body language or facial grimace, that would have ended the discussion. On the other end of the spectrum, if I said something in response such as, "Oh, you cut her head off. No big deal, I know a lot of guys who did that," the murderer wouldn't be inclined to give me much further detail either. Humoring violent criminals is not the way to deal with them. These people may be crazy, but they're not stupid, nor entirely insensitive to the nuances of interpersonal behavior. Most interrogators move in too quickly to ask the difficult questions. Then the mental barriers go up and the interview is effectively terminated. These inmates have all the time in the world, and if they don't feel comfortable, you'll come out of the interview with nothing. Therefore, it's imperative to spend time allowing them to feel good about revealing intimate details of their lives to you. I proceed slowly, stroking, probing gently, and moving closer and closer until I feel the moment is right to ask the hard questions. Sometimes it takes many hours or multiple visits. A number of men and women who worked in the behavioral sciences unit were not up to the formidable task of interviewing convicted violent criminals for one reason or another. One colleague of mine had to interview a man who had molested and murdered several children. The interviewer had children of his own, disliked the killer because of it, and the interview session became hopelessly compromised. When the inmate objected to cigarette smoke in the room and wanted to open a window, the agent responded that he should sit down and answer the questions without objection. When the interview subject was asked one of our standard questions, what he might rather have done if he had not entered into criminal pursuits, the convicted man said he would like to have been an astronaut.
"Yeah, and you'd have liked to have a little boy there in the cabin with you," the agent said in an aside to an FBI colleague in the room.
That was unnecessarily hostile behavior on the agent's part, antagonistic questioning that defeated the purpose of the interview. The agent had fallen victim to the stress of the situation. Shortly thereafter, this agent came to me, for I was the one who had sent him to interview the child molester, and admitted that he wasn't cut out for interviewing. "I can't work with these animals," he told me. I admired his courage in facing up to his shortcomings. He took up another specialty. In short order, he became one of our stars in the area of police stress and psychological counseling of law enforcement personnel. There had been no files on his talent and potential to do good work, but he wasn't suited to the difficult task of interviewing convicted child molesters and trying to extract from the interviews something of help to law enforcement. Lots of people wanted in on the criminal personality research project, but most of them didn't want to do the hard work. They'd be all too glad to traipse along on interviews of high-profile murderers such as Manson or Berkowitz, but they didn't want to put in the time and effort necessary to properly interview a criminal who was less well-known, but whose crimes were equally heinous. Many hours of preparation were necessary before going into a prison. Then, prior to conducting the interview, there were prison records to be combed over, and part of our lengthy protocol to complete. Interviews with inmates regularly lasted 3 and 4 hours, and immediately afterward you had to debrief yourself in order to complete the rest of the protocol, as well as other administrative tasks. Nearly everyone in our unit fell victim to its situational stress. One woman profiler bailed out after a few years because the work was giving her nightmares. She found herself unable to deal rationally with cases in which someone broke into a house and raped a woman. She, too, went on to other work for the FBI. Several of our people developed bleeding ulcers, and 3 had anxiety attacks that were so severe that they were initially misperceived as heart attacks. 4 of us, myself included, had periods of rapid and unexplained weight loss, some 20 to 40 pounds in 6-month periods. We went for batteries of tests, including the standard gastrointestinal series, and no purely physical reasons for the weight loss were discovered. It was all stress-related. Another male agent fell under the spell of one mass murderer so completely that he would misrepresent the man's antagonism toward me in order that only he would have access to this murderer. The agent even passed to the murderer a good deal of bureau-developed information, from which the murderer hoped to fashion a successful appeal of his death sentence. The bizarre behavior on the part of the agent occurred because the murderer was a masterful manipulator, and because the novice was unprepared for the amount of control the murderer was able to exert on those who crossed his path. The agent even managed to entangle in his exploits a bureau paper shuffler. Soon, the supervisor wanted to go along with the agent to interview the murderer, The supervisor, too, had dreams of later boasting how close he had been to a glamorous and evil figure. When the murderer was finally executed, the agent was ashen and disoriented, as stricken as if he had just lost a close friend or relative. A startling example of the dangers of his having peered far too deeply into the abyss. Stability in one's life enables one to keep some helpful distance from the work of interviewing violent criminals. But even when the agents involved are basically stable, as I am, the stress is considerable. Of course, I didn't know the extent of the stress I would encounter when I began doing these prison interviews in 1978. A word about the circumstances of the interviews. Most outsiders visiting a prison are allowed only limited access to prisoners, even if the visitor is family or legal counsel. You speak through a hole in a glass or on a telephone, or in some other way are at a distance from the prisoner. I was usually permitted to conduct the interviews in an attorney's room or a guard captain's quarters, so I could sit in relative comfort with the convict. Occasionally, prisoners would be brought to the room handcuffed. Invariably, I'd ask that these cuffs be removed. It was part of trying to reach rapport with the person being interviewed. When I began an interview, the inmate would naturally be curious about what the FBI wanted with him, and so I'd begin by talking about him, demonstrating the depth of my knowledge, and saying that I wasn't here to seek information on a particular crime, but rather just to research certain categories of offenders. I didn't say that it was sexual murderers. To do so would have been a mistake. I told the inmate I wanted to know about his childhood, his entire life, and that anything they told me would not be passed on to the prison authorities. This last rule was quite important because that was the inmate's largest fear, that some of the intimate details they might divulge to me would become known to the prison apparatus, and that the authorities would somehow use it against them. For some reason, perhaps it was my earnest assurances, they believed me, and I've kept my promises. I also warned the inmates not to speak of any crimes that had not been adjudicated. For instance, an admission that they'd really killed 24 people, not a dozen. Because if they did so, I would have to read them their rights, and the information might lead to an investigation, and so on. Nearly everyone wants to talk to Charles Manson, primarily in order to be able to say they've done so, not really because they have a need to hear what Manson has to say. Manson and some of the others have been interviewed repeatedly by journalists and sensation seekers of one sort or another and are sick of such treatment. I recall an interview that television and radio host Tom Snyder did with Manson a few years ago, in which Snyder asked Manson what it felt like to slice off an ear. That was just the sort of question that could have been calculated to turn off Manson, to make him ease into glibness and evasion and hostility toward the interviewer. I could tell from watching the interview that at that point Manson's respect for Snyder declined to nil. "This guy's a dummy," I could almost hear Manson saying in his mind. "He's playing games, so I'll play games too." That was the end, as far as extracting any serious information was concerned. Snyder might profitably have asked Manson what reason he had for slicing off an ear, and might have obtained an interesting answer, one that would probably have to do with the relevance of that bizarre act to Manson's fantasy. Snyder went in a different direction, however, and ended up with nothing of value to anyone, except perhaps in terms of titillating the audience. In talking to these spectacular criminal personalities, I found it was imperative to be extremely well prepared so that they understood I wasn't there to waste their time. I had to impress on them that I was worthy of being talked to. Being well prepared about their lives and cases was one aspect of my presentation of self that convinced them I might be deserving of trust. For instance, when the inmate was in the midst of a story, it always helped if I knew the names and other antecedents to which he referred. "Now Bobby would take me along to meet some drug dealers," Manson began a story, and before he could continue, I butted in,
Bobby Beausoleil?
Yeah,
he responded. And then he went on, secure in the knowledge that his questioner had done enough homework to be familiar with every known fact in his life story, that I understood all the references. I had made the interjection to demonstrate just that, to tell him that I knew what he was talking about and considered it important. In reaction, he raised the level of his candor. Talking with Tom Snyder, Manson had to go slowly and explain everything, and as a consequence said nothing of importance. To an interviewer who approached him with respect, as I did, Manson could clip along, rattle out matters he'd thought about, portions of his story that no law enforcement person had ever heard before, confident that I knew enough of the background to be able to follow what he was saying. Another aid to my interviews was my consistent attempt to find and discuss something positive in the lives of these killers. Tex Watson had been born again. We could start with that. Herons had been an exemplary prisoner. It was more difficult to find something positive with a man such as Manson, of course, but at least I could zero in on something that he might consider positive in his world, even if the rest of humanity might not consider it in the same way. In Manson's case, it was the way in which people related to him. Manson wanted to inform me. Once we got past what I later came to label as the courtship phase of a conversation, that he really didn't know why he was in prison this time, because he had not been present when the murders were committed. More deeply, he wanted to impress on me that he was not truly guilty. If you hold up a photographic negative, Manson maintained, you see a version of the world that is reversed. Manson said he was that sort of negative of society, a reflection of society that showed all of its bad aspects. Key to deciphering the enigma of Charlie Manson is the fact that, indeed, he had had a rotten early life. By the time he was 32, he had been in prison or juvenile institutions 20 years, from his teenage years up until the day when he emerged from the Terminal Island facility in California with the determination to remain out of prison for the rest of his life. Many men who were criminals in their teens and 20s mature out of their antisocial behavior in the early 30s and do manage to sustain non-criminal lives after getting out. A small man, physically unprepossessing at 5'6 and 130 pounds, Manson was perceptive emotionally. In prison, he had learned to play the guitar and even wrote some music. He planned to be a musician and earn his living that way. When he got out of prison, it was the middle 1960s, and he was able to slip right into the counterculture life that was then becoming prevalent among young people on the West Coast. He locked into the youth movement and rode it.
I could see the kind of people the kids were shining up to, Manson told me, so I became that.
He understood, perhaps better than the youngsters, what and who they respected. People with long hair, people who wore sandals on their feet, people somewhat out of the ordinary who spoke in metaphysical terms, played guitars, and wrote songs that few could comprehend. Manson found that he could walk up and down the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, the heart of the acid, LSD, culture, and that because he was older than the hippies by a dozen years, because he appeared in certain garb and behaved in a certain way, the kids would flock to him.
I looked at what they wanted to see, and I became that.
Soon he was getting free meals, free lodging, free sex, free dope, and had set himself up as a sort of guru.
I became a negative, he told me. A reflection of these kids.
Manson explained this image by saying that when you hold up a mirror, you don't actually see the mirror, but rather what is reflected in its shiny surface.
They were looking for themselves, Manson avowed. Hey, I'm not a real big guy. I can't go kicking ass. I have to get things by using my brain.
The staring, hypnotic eyes served him well. He found he could control some youngsters better than others, and that these would do whatever he asked. In the desert near Death Valley, he ran what amounted to a summer camp for aberrant, wayward kids. Older than they were, more experienced in the methods of manipulation learned in 20 years of being a convict, he broke down the kids' defenses and began to require more and more of them, until they went beyond marginal incursions into illegality and committed serious crimes. Manson had concluded that because he had done nothing more than mirror what his disciples wished to become, he was not really responsible for their murderous actions. That was the reason he didn't know why he was in prison. This explanation was baldly ingenuous, of course, because Manson refused to take into account his own lifelong psychopathic personality and his bent toward achieving power. But still, in our discussion, he expounded in an unmistakable way on the techniques by which he had dominated the young people around him. An understanding of his manipulative genius is key to decoding the murders that he and his disciples committed. He didn't point-blank order the murders, as Prosecutor Bugliosi charged, but rather he created the climate in which his disciples knew what they had to do to please him, and they wished to do so. At that moment in the LaBianca home, when the murders themselves were about to be committed, Manson told his kids that he was leaving the house to go outside, because, as a former convict, he ought not to be present when the actual crime went down, because it would violate the terms of his parole. His disciples believed this explanation. Once during our interview, Manson became a bit wild, jumping on the table to demonstrate the ways in which guards controlled prisoners in the institutions. I would have let him rant and rave some more, but John Conway told him flatly, "Charlie, get off the table, sit down, and behave yourself." In this instance, Conway's unwillingness to indulge Manson's theatrics was the appropriate response, for after the table hopping, Manson did sit down, and was more forthcoming about his techniques of mental control. Near the end of the interview, Manson begged me to give him something that he could take back to his cell. He wanted a souvenir so that he could say he'd ripped off an FBI agent. Otherwise, he suggested, no one would believe he'd spent all this time talking to us. He'd have a lot of explaining to do, and that might lower his status among the inmates. He grabbed my FBI badge and held it up to his shirt, then acted as if he was issuing orders to guards and other inmates. I told him he couldn't have that. Manson admired a pair of old aviator sunglasses I'd brought with me, and I decided they were certainly a gift I was prepared to donate. He took them and put them in his breast pocket, but cautioned that the guards would probably accuse him of stealing them. Sure enough, that's precisely what happened. Manson was brought back in to me by the guards, straining and protesting all the way about the perversity of anyone believing him capable of pilfering. With a straight face, I attested that I'd given the sunglasses to him. The guards looked at me as if I was a jerk. Then, with his best strut, and with the glasses incongruously perched on his face, hiding those fearsome eyes, Charlie Manson strode down the hall. I have no doubts that once back in the population, he bragged about having put one over on the FBI. It was a shining example of Manson's manipulative tricks. For me, the glasses and the momentary loss of dignity were a small price to pay for unique insight into the mind of a murderer. On my initial trip through the prisons, I proceeded from Manson's prison down the California coast to the San Luis Obispo prison to interview Charles Tex Watson. Watson claimed to have found Jesus in prison. He had been saved and born again, and had actually become a rather renowned preacher. People would come from surrounding communities, as well as from the prison population, to hear him on Sundays. Frankly, he seemed to have the penal authorities snookered. He walked around as if he owned the place. The administrators there thought of him as doing good work, that he was a shining example of rehabilitation. To my mind, there was no question that he was doing good work and helping people. Whether his proselytizing was completely genuine or a line that he pursued in the belief that it would eventually assure his parole, I could not be certain. Watson was a rather normal-appearing man, certainly so to me, just then, after having visited Sirhan Sirhan, Charles Manson, and Ed Kemper. He readily admitted that, at the time of the Tate-LaBianca murders, he had been out of his mind on drugs and under the total influence of Manson. Had justice been served then, he said, he would have been executed right after the trial. But he was spared. Satan had left him, and he had been taken into the hand of the Lord and was truly a different man than the one who had committed the crimes. In the book, Will You Die For Me?, written with the prison chaplain Ray Hoekstra, Watson placed all the blame on Manson, saying that Manson ordered his disciples to kill. Just before the Tate murders, Manson had taken care of a bad situation for Watson by stabbing a drug dealer they had ripped off and told Watson to reciprocate and kill some pigs for him. In his conversations with me, Watson admitted that Manson had not given him direct and explicit orders to commit murder, but that there had been no question that Manson understood what Watson and the others were going to do, did not stop it, and that Manson later reveled in the knowledge that it had been done for him. Watson had grown up in a small Texas town and had been the All-American boy. Honor student, track star, my record in high hurdles still stands. Yell leader, the boy next door with the crew cut and the prize-winning calf, he described himself in his book. Graduating from college in the late 1960s, he drifted to California, he told me, yearning to experience the beach, the sun, the girls, the mind-bending drugs, the easy life. He fell in with Manson by chance, began to hang around him, and then gave up everything else in his life to be near Manson. Now, after having been in prison for some time, Watson understood Manson. Charlie had acted like an old convict, he told me, wrapping a new one around his finger. Manson hadn't turned him into a homosexual as he had done to others, Watson told me, but Manson had made him into a slave. When I started taking acid, Watson wrote, Charlie was not an important figure in my life. However, one friend was an evangelist for the Gospel According to Charlie, and the Family Girls echoed the philosophy constantly. They said that each one of us has an ego, a desire to assert ourselves and our existence as something separate and cut off from the rest of life around us. We hang on to that ego, thinking that independent self is the only thing that lets us survive, thinking without it we'd perish. But true freedom means giving up ourselves, letting that old ego die so we can be free of the self that keeps us from one another, keeps us from life itself. Cease to exist, Charlie sang in one of the songs he'd written. Cease to exist. Come say you love me. The girls repeated it over and over. Cease to exist. Kill your ego. Die. So that once you cease to be, you can be free to totally love, totally come together. Manson broke down the personalities of those around him by means of mind-altering drugs, by verbal assaults on his disciples' personalities, by embroiling them in orgies. Every night after dinner, Manson would climb up on a mound in back of their ranch and spout his philosophy to an adoring audience stoned on drugs. The past, he preached, must be put behind them and ridiculed, especially their birth families and middle-class roots. All that mattered was the new family, the family. Manson was in his early 30s, and the family was urged to think of him as the new Christ, who had also been in his mid-30s when crucified. Like Christ, Manson was going to change the world. Manson, too, spoke in apocalyptic phrases and derided the teachings of the fathers and preached love. To symbolize the new personality of each acolyte after he was exposed to Manson's truth, Manson gave them new names. Watson became Tex, not only because of his origins and the twang in his speaking voice, but also because there could be only one Charlie in the Manson family. Actually, the rivalry between Manson and Watson, which I learned about from both men, was a definite factor in the dynamics of the murders. The key was the sermons from the mound, though. Manson would say that the old world was about to come to an end, that he would lead his flock into a secret entrance in the desert where they would wait out the apocalypse and then emerge to repopulate the earth. To provoke actions that would hurry up the coming destruction of the present world, Manson said, there ought to be some bloody murders. Charlie repeated a litany from his hill. He had been cheated out of childhood. He had never had a birthday party or a life. He had been screwed since the day he was born. To balance what had been done to him, Manson preached, some pigs had to be killed. He defined pigs as middle-class, advantaged people who he thought should be rousted out of their comfortable lives by being confronted with torture and bloody murder. As bizarre as Charlie's teachings might sound to an outsider, Watson wrote, it was compelling to us. The more acid we took, and the more we listened, the more obvious and inevitable it all seemed. Manson would talk to them while they were in the throes of LSD and paint compelling word pictures of killing and torture. Then, we'd all follow Charlie's lead and imagine the butchery and the terror, and even though it was all just a game, the images stayed locked in our brains after the game was over. One night, after some of this role-playing, Watson gathered up a few of the girls and told them and Manson they were sallying forth to do the devil's work. He, Watson, would be the ringleader and take the responsibility for the actual killings. The women, trained by Manson in the need to devote their lives to serving men, would be his accomplices. Watson claims that he told Manson, "We're doing this for you, Charlie." And that Manson responded, "Yeah, Tex, do it, and do it right." Manson told me that he had merely advised Watson, "Do what you have to do." I believe their two stories essentially coincide and are not contradictory. If Manson did not directly order the murders, he nonetheless made it eminently clear that he condoned them and would not stop his disciples from killing. Though the murders were Charlie's fantasy, conveyed to his kids often in verbal descriptions that were overtly violent, they, not he, would make that fantasy into a gruesome reality and thereby hasten the end of the bad vibrations world that had to end before Charlie's peace and love would start a new one. Since, on the basis of Manson's instructions, all of his disciples had earlier committed burglaries and stolen cars and money, and the women had slept with men at his direction and generally obeyed his every whim, when Manson did not overtly prevent Watson and the women from going out to murder, he more than blessed the action. That wasn't the whole story, however. In his own interview with me, Manson had confided that the dumbest thing he'd ever done was to let that SOB Watson have too much power in the family. And Watson casually acknowledged to me that he certainly had been attempting to elevate himself in the family power structure, to get the girls to look to him for authority. By committing murder, Watson sought to become, if not the leader of the family, then Manson's chief lieutenant, a man who all must respect because of the enormity of his crimes and his familiarity with violence. So the Tate-LaBianca murders were not carefully planned, masterminded executions, but rather snowballing events in which a bunch of screwed-up runaway kids, their personalities burned out of them, and caught in a familial power struggle, took part in disasters that snuffed out a half-dozen lives. I had wanted to speak with other members of the Manson family in the California prisons, principally Susan Atkins, who had assisted in the murders, but could not manage that on my initial trip. At the Alderson Federal Women's Penitentiary in West Virginia, however, I did see Lynette Squeaky Frome and Sandra Good. Neither one had been present at the actual murders, but they had been around Manson for a considerable amount of time. When these two girls came into the interview room, it was like something out of a movie. Squeaky wore a red outfit and a matching red bandana around her head, and Sandra wore a green outfit and a green bandana as a headband. They approached in the posture of nuns, walking together, moving in unison. In their conversation, they called each other red and green, and proclaimed they were sisters in the church of Charles Manson. Squeaky Fromm had come from a normal family, well-educated participants in the space program. Sandra Good had a master's degree. Both were intelligent, but had yielded up their lives to Manson. Squeaky was convicted of having pulled a .45 caliber pistol on President Gerald Ford and squeezing the trigger. The gun did not go off because a Secret Service agent had put his hand between the hammer and the firing pin and had been injured in the process. Sandra had been convicted of attempting to extort through the mails. She had written letters to directors of large corporations, telling them that unless they ceased polluting the earth, Manson family members, who were all over the place in hiding, would start killing the directors and their families. In prison, the girls, who were now women in their 30s, kept the faith. One day they believed Charlie would emerge from prison and restart the movement that would be the only hope for Earth's future, and they would join him in the endeavor. They told me that even if I had brought with me presidential commutations for them both, they would not leave prison until Manson also had been released. I didn't get much more from them than that, and verification of the willingness of inadequate personalities to submit their lives and destinies to a psychotic man who led them very far astray. Sandra Good was released from prison in late 1991 and moved to a town 25 miles from Manson's prison. Richard Speck was not really a serial killer, but what I call a mass murderer. One terrible night in Chicago during the late 1960s, he had entered a house with the intent of robbing it, and found student nurses there. Others returned during the course of the evening. He tied them up. Some of the American nurses told the others to go along with this, because they were convinced if they did so, he wouldn't harm them, though the Filipino nurses objected. One by one, he took them into another room, assaulted them, and then killed 8 of them, mainly so they could not identify him. A 9th student had rolled under the bed and lived through the experience of having Speck assault and kill one of her friends directly above her. Speck must have lost count, because after the 8th murder, he left the house. The 9th nurse came out and provided the police with a good description, including that of a tattoo on Speck that read, "Born to Raise Hell." That description had been sent to hospital emergency rooms on the odd chance that this violent man might injure himself. Sending such descriptions around is a usual police technique, which, in this instance, paid off. A few days later, when Speck showed up in a hospital with a wound in his elbow, the tattoo was recognized and Speck was arrested. One of my questions to Speck was going to be about that apparently self-inflicted wound on his inner elbow. The surviving nurse positively identified Speck, as did some fingerprints left at the scene of the murders, and he was convicted and sent to prison for life. I wanted to interview Speck because he was a well-known murderer, but he wasn't very intelligent and seemed to have no insight into his crimes. According to the prison counselors, he was a bully whose assaultive and violent behavior was well known in the prison system and out. Prior to going to Chicago, he had been a fugitive from Texas, where he was wanted for the attempted murder of his father-in-law. In the months just before the murders, Speck's idea of having a good night on the town was to get drunk, take some pills, then go to a bar and pick on another patron until he got into a fight. If he beat up his opponent badly, that was a successful evening. If not, he'd look for a hooker and beat her badly before falling asleep. In prison, a guard told me, Speck had captured a sparrow and made a pet of it, tied a string around its leg and wore it on his shoulder. One of the guards told him to get rid of it, as pets were not allowed in prisons. Speck did not. After several go-rounds, the guard told Speck that if he didn't get rid of the sparrow, he would be put into solitary. At that, Speck walked over to a rotating fan and threw the bird in. It was demolished. The surprised guard said, "What did you do that for? I thought you liked the sparrow." "I did," Speck was reported as saying, "but if it ain't mine, it ain't nobody's." Speck didn't want to talk to us, and was surly and posturing when he was brought in to see us. One of the prison guards began talking to him, though, and eventually told Speck that he had been a single man in Chicago at the time of Speck's murders and was a bit annoyed that Speck had taken 8 eligible young women away from the prowling bachelors of the city. Speck started to chuckle and then loosened up a bit. I was uneasy because I always make it a point in my interviews not to get into the gutter with the murderer and, just as important, never to make light of the victims. To me, there's no excuse for deprecating those who have suffered simply to get on the good side of a murderer. Nonetheless, we tried to use the opening that the guard had made to talk to Speck. As I quickly discovered, he didn't have much to say and little insight into his own condition. Speck displayed a callousness for human life, admitting that he had killed his victims so they couldn't testify against him. Frustrated by his low intelligence and bad attitude, I tried to get something out of the interview and inquired as to how he had ended up in the hospital where his tattoo had been recognized. Though several doctors believed that the cut to the artery in his elbow had been the result of a botched suicide attempt made in the flophouse where he lived after the murders, Speck denied this, saying that he'd been in a fight in a bar and had been cut by a broken whiskey bottle. 10 years after the crime, he was still trying to be the macho man. On the other end of the scale from Richard Speck was Ted Bundy, who became the most celebrated killer of his time, perhaps because he was so photogenic and so articulate that many people concluded he could not have committed the crimes for which he'd been convicted. A handsome, intelligent young man, who seemed to some people to have considerable sex appeal, Bundy was painted by the media as a smooth guy, respected, clean, a former law student, a Mr. Nice Guy, almost a benign killer, a good lover who would kill his victims quickly. Far from being the Rudolph Valentino of the serial killer world, Ted Bundy was a brutal, sadistic, perverted man. His last victim was a 12-year-old girl whom he suffocated by shoving her face in the mud during his sexual assault. By his verbal skills, Bundy would habitually lure girls and young women into a position of vulnerability, then bludgeon them with a short crowbar that he had concealed in a cast on his arm or hidden under the seat of his car. He would then commit gross sexual acts with the unconscious or semi-conscious women, his favorite practice being anal assaults. After that, he'd kill them by strangulation, then transport the bodies, often several hundred miles. Before leaving them, he would mutilate and dismember them, and sometimes commit necrophilic acts. After several days, he often returned to the body of a recent victim and sexually attacked the severed body parts, for instance, ejaculating into the mouth of a disembodied head. This guy was an animal, and it amazed me that the media seemed unable to understand that. Following Bundy's execution at a seminar run by the FBI at Quantico, the police officers from all over the country who had been trying to question him estimated that he had murdered between 35 and 60 young women in a dozen states. Bundy had begun his career in Seattle, and after 11 homicides had brought the authorities very close to him, he moved southeast, leaving a trail of bodies behind him until he reached the ski resorts of Colorado, where he settled for a while. He was apprehended in Colorado, but escaped, was recaptured, and escaped a second time, after which he again proceeded southeast, committing more homicides on his way to Florida. I had briefly and tangentially been involved in his case when he became a fugitive from Colorado. I worked with Chief Profiler Howard Teton on an assessment that became part of a wanted poster. We alerted people to the killer's M.O. He would go to locations where young people congregated, beaches, ski resorts, discos, colleges, and look for young, attractive, outdoors-type women who parted their long hair in the middle. After Bundy's conviction and the exhaustion of most of the appeals, I wanted to interview Bundy for our research project because he was articulate and intelligent, and I hoped he would add to our base of knowledge. On my first visit to his prison in Stark, Florida, I wasted several days trying to see him and was delayed because of certain pending appeals, and eventually had to leave the interviewing task to associates because I was due to teach at a Rhodes school. A few years later, we at the BSU were surprised to receive a letter from Bundy asking to see our records and crime scene photographs on the 36 incarcerated killers included in